5:32 here on Downtown, the ride home on a Wednesday afternoon. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell with you. Forty years ago, Bruce Springsteen released Darkness on the Edge of Town, Prove It All Night, the lone top 40 single from that album, but a very important album in Bruce's career. To talk about that, our friend Dan Epstein joins us. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rich. Nice to be back.
Terrific piece in RollingStone.com on the 40th anniversary. And people forget, I think, that there was a little wait between albums for Springsteen because of the legal troubles that he faced after Born to Run. And boy, at that time in the recording business, time when you didn't release an album was time when your career could be slipping away.
Absolutely. I mean, back in the 1970s, it was pretty common for major artists to release a new record every year, maybe every year and a half, but you didn't go 2 years between releases, and it was almost 3 years between Born to Run and Darkness on the Edge of Town. And, you know, especially when you consider that Born to Run was the album that really, you know, that was the one that busted Springsteen into the mainstream. So, you know, after your first big success, you kind of want to come back swinging as soon as possible. But that didn't happen with Darkness on the Edge of Town.
And it was a very different album from Born to Run, a change in tone and style for Springsteen.
It really was. I mean, it was much more stripped down sonically. And the band arrangements were all, most of the tracks were recorded live in the studio, and then, you know, with Springsteen would overdub vocals and guitar, and, you know, band members would overdub certain instruments, but the basic tracks were done live, like, you know, they were used to playing on stage, and he'd never really done that before. But he was also kind of working with some new influences. He had really started getting into country music, Woody Guthrie, and he'd started getting into punk rock. He'd picked up a lot of the, you know, the Clash and Sex Pistols records that had been coming out in England, and was really kind of into the way that they, you know, forcefully and simply stated their case, and, you know, the anger that they packed into the grooves. And you know, if you listen to Darkness today, you can really kind of hear that, you know, both the punk and the country influences.
And as you mentioned in your Rolling Stone piece, he was also looking for a cinematic feel to this album.
Yeah, he'd actually spent a lot of time. I think part of it was just all the downtime he had slugging it out in the courtroom with his former manager, but he spent a lot of time watching classic movies, a lot of noir films from the 40s and 50s, and then a lot of westerns, John Ford type of stuff. And said he really wanted to give the record. I mean, certainly you could argue that Born to Run has a pretty cinematic sweep in itself, but he really wanted it to be kind of have a dramatic flow. And, you know, it's not a concept album in the sense that we're following one character through the whole story, but there really is kind of a movie-like aspect to it. You know, it's you know, like you get flashes of things like, you know, everything from On the Waterfront to you know, to Badlands, the Terrence Malick film, and it's still a pretty great headphone listen. In a lot of ways.
I was surprised to learn from your piece, too, that maybe one of the most familiar sounds from the Darkness on the Edge of Town album, that epic Clarence Clemons sax solo, was not part of the original plan, that it was something Springsteen added late because the album was getting maybe, what, a little guitar heavy?
Oh, well, you mean on Badlands?
Yeah.
I think he wanted the record to have a more kind of not rural feel per se, but more kind of, you know, hearkening back to the you know, industrial towns of Jersey. And he felt like the saxophone was really too much of an urban sound. And Born to Run had been a very urban record, very, you know, a lot of New York in that. And And so he wanted the guitars to be much louder and more prominent on Darkness, also because they're much, you know, angrier sounding instrument than the saxophone, and there's a lot of anger in the tracks. But he got the record all the way to the mastering stage. I mean, this is where it's like the mixes have already been signed off and they're cutting it to actually press the record, when he realized that he needed a little more big man on the record, and that where there had originally been a, you know, lengthy guitar solo on Badlands, he decided that he needed Clarence to come in and blow his horn.
We're talking to Dan Epstein here on Downtown 40th Anniversary of Darkness on the Edge of Town. And as we talked about the influences, one of them, the Animals, how did he present a little homage to the Animals on this album?
Yeah, Eric Burdon and the Animals, all those 60s hits, like It's My Life and Don't Bring Me Down and We Gotta Get Out of This Place, those were big records for him as a kid in you know, growing up in Freehold, New Jersey. And so he really wanted to put a lot of that kind of, you know, working class energy and anger that he picked up on those records into this one. And I think It's My Life?
Yes.
That he sort of took the main riff from it and worked it into...
Misunderstood.
It was Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which was the one on this record that he later admitted that he stole. It was Badlands. It was the main riff for Badlands. He admitted when he did his 2012 speech at South by Southwest, he played Badlands on acoustic guitar for the crowd. And then played Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, and showed how he, you know, pulled from one to the other. But he did it, you know, in a somewhat subtle way. So, like, unless somebody told you that, you wouldn't necessarily know it.
So many times Springsteen would record songs or come in with song ideas, and they wouldn't make the cut for an album. And in the case of Darkness on the Edge of Town, two of the best-known Springsteen songs that became hits by other artists were part of that original session but didn't make it to the album.
Yeah, I think he had a vision for the album that, you know, he was writing all kinds of stuff during the lead-up to the recording sessions and then during the recording sessions themselves. And though they were good songs, he didn't, you know, he had a very specific image of an idea of what would fit on there. And he wrote a song called Fire, which he claims he originally wrote for Elvis Presley, but Elvis died before he could get it to him. And then a song called Because of the Night, which he actually never finished because it was a love song. And he realized that a love song like that probably wouldn't fit on Darkness. And B, he felt that he was too immature and unwilling to really commit on several levels to a song like that. So he gave so the Pointer Sisters, of all people, recorded Fire and had a huge hit with that, top five hit, and with their version. And then Patti Smith was recording across the hall at the record plant, I believe, also with the same guy who was in engineering Darkness on the Edge of Town. And Patti needed a song to flesh out her Easter record. And so Bruce kind of knew Patti from the New York scene and admired what she did and let her have the song. And she filled out the rest of the lyrics, and she wound up having a big hit with Because of the Night.
A lot of people look at Darkness on the Edge of Town as one of their favorite Springsteen albums. From your perspective, where does it rank?
It's right up there. I mean, to me, I would say my two favorites are probably Darkness and The Wild, The Innocent, The E Street Shuffle, which are two incredibly different records. But I think that the thing with Darkness is, you know, and I kind of realized this as I was writing this piece and going back and listening to it, like so much of how we think of Springsteen now and so much of what he has done since then were really defined more by Darkness than Born to Run or any of the other records he'd done before it. It was kind of like this is the record that really set the template of Springsteen as we know and love him now.
We're talking with Dan Epstein here on Downtown. Dan, we're looking back throughout the spring and summer at 1968 and wanted to talk with you about a couple of big musical occurrences of that year. One, the release of the Beatles, the White Album that came out in November of 68, a double album set that I think has been described by some people as the sound of a band in the midst of breaking up. Only half the songs on the album had all four Beatles on board, and yet some really great music on that album.
Oh yeah, I mean it's you know the stuff that's great is absolutely you know classic and immortal on there. I mean several rock critic friends and I have played the game over the years of like, you know, if you could turn the White Album into a single album, which songs would you put on there? And it's interesting to me because nobody ever agrees on which song you know would make it onto one. So you know, obviously there's it gets a bit self-indulgent, and you know, Revolution Number 9 is it can be a little tough to take at times. But really, I love the whole thing, and I love the atmosphere of it, the sound, you know, just the recording of it is beautiful. And there are, you know, I mean, how many other bands had that many great songs that they could just dump onto a two record set? And you know, and again, like, you know, we're talking about how, you know, how quickly bands followed up albums in those days. I mean, that record came out really not that long after Magical Mystery Tour, which you know also was had all kinds of incredible songs on it. So yeah, I think it's a wonderful record, and I think the first song I actually ever liked on loved on that record was Piggies. I heard it on the Dr. Demento show when I was like 10, and then you know, then pulled out my dad's copy and listened to it, and started listening to the other songs from there.
Well, and I love what it meant to future projects, too, because after they were all sort of, in many ways, doing their own thing on this album, it wasn't long after that they committed to doing it the old way one last time, which would eventually lead to Abbey Road.
Right, exactly, which is also just a fantastic record. I mean, I feel like the only Beatles record that I would say, it's not that I don't like it, but it just seems so much less than everything else they recorded, was Get Back, which is sort of like taking the, you know, they were trying to make it, I'm sorry, it wasn't Get Back. It was Get Back was what they were originally calling the Sessions. God, why am I drawing a blank?
Let It Be.
Let It Be. There we go. And, so I feel, you know, those, even though that was released after Abbey Road, it was recorded beforehand. And I think Abbey Road, it's a shame that wasn't the last Beatles album released, because I think it, you know, especially Side Two is such a wonderful piece of music and really, you know, it was such an exclamation point to the band's amazing career.
Another epic musical moment late in 1968, the Elvis Presley comeback special. I was watching clips of it again the other night, and boy, it had been years since anybody had really seen him perform live. He'd been doing those god-awful movies, and then with Bill Black and the crew there, you saw that magic of Elvis once again.
Yeah, you know, I was 2 years old when it aired, so I don't really have a memory of it from the time, but like people I know who were older and were Elvis fans said that, like, you really can't imagine how exciting it was to see him on TV in black leather, you know, singing "If You're Looking for Trouble, You're in the Right Place." Just like that moment was so like, yes, this is the Elvis that we thought had vanished, and he's here again. And you know, it was a huge shot in the arm for Elvis's career and his credibility. And you know, and I don't know I don't know how many people remember this, but for me, my favorite part of the entire special is when he sings "If I Can Dream" at the end, which you know, coming at a time of, you know, extreme upheaval, social upheaval in the U.S., and it was a pretty heavy and powerful statement for a mainstream entertainer to make. And you can really tell, you know, from his performance how into what he's saying, what he's singing about, he is. It's, you know, he's not walking through it. It's incredibly heartfelt. And I get chills every time I watch that performance.
Absolutely. I was just watching it the other night, and you nailed it completely. And by the way, Dan, before we let you go, a big thank you. We love your posts daily on some great funky baseball birthdays. Nothing has made me smile this week more than seeing the unibrow of Andy Etchebarren.
Yeah, I'm wearing a unibrow today in Andy's honor.
He was one of my favorites as a kid because those baseball cards of his were just classics.
Yeah, definitely. Once you saw Andy Etchebarren's face, you never forgot it.
They were so good they made that gum in the baseball card pack taste good.
Yeah.
Dan, as always, it's a great treat for us to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us this afternoon, and we'll talk with you again soon.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rich. Always a pleasure.